Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Done it.
Welcome to the Black House. Wow, that was loud. That was really loud. We're back on the air. We've got a full house tonight. Today. We've got Sasha, we've got Larry, we've got Byron, we've got London, and behind the camera we've got Mia.
Hi.
And we're going to be having a very interesting discussion today, but first I want to do... Welcome back, guys. Actually, thank you for coming in for this because I think it's a really important topic and we need to like start talking about it here. And but first, before I even get into that, I just want to do a couple of community announcements. The first is on the 7th of July is World Kiswahili Day, and Africa Connection Aotearoa is doing another 4-week interactive Kiswahili language workshop. This time it's going to be running for 4 weeks on Sundays from 2 to 4 p.m. from the 2nd of July to the fourth week after that. I didn't even write that. So from the 2nd of July, be going for 4 weeks. And it's going to be running out of Palmerston North, which is really exciting that they're going to have the Kiswahili workshop up there, because what else comes to Palmerston North from Africa? There's not much. So they're free lessons, and you can contact Wenjiku Kiari, and the poster is up on the Black House socials on Instagram and on Facebook. You can go there, you'll find her number, you'll find the link to go to Africa Connection Aotearoa on their Facebook page. So if you are keen to learn Kiswahili in an interactive 4 week, I've done it. I've done a couple of lessons when they did it in Wellington, and it was fun. I am useless at Swahili. I'm probably the only Tanzanian person in the world that is useless at Swahili, but I don't care. It wasn't my fault. So, it's actually a fun class, and I hope that Palmerston North gets in there and supports, and talk to Wanjiku if you're able to drive up to Palmy on these weekends when they're running it. The other message or community notice I wanted to put out today is that Africa Day in Parliament is going to be on June the 8th. RSVPs need to be in by June 1st, guys. So if you want to come to this event, everybody from the African community and surrounds are invited. So you can go to the Black House page or the African Community Council's of Wellington Facebook page for the link to the RSVP. Come along. It's always flash to go up to the Parliament, like hang out, just hang out and have fun, crash the party. It's all good. So, and for the Parliament, they do need to have an RSVP because they've got limits on the building or whatnot. So, those are my only community notices. Oh, also today in Auckland, they're having Africa Day. I'm sure later on today there'll be some amazing pictures and photos from that. Tendakai DJ Dozen has gone up for that. And Nadine, DJ Oracle, is performing there, and a few other people. So I think it's going to be a massive day up there. I wanted to fly up, but I was going to be here for this episode because I really want to do this episode. So what I want to say, I'm not going to run, everybody knows everybody, so I'm not going to run through everybody's names. Everybody knows who you are. We're going to have a conversation today about critical race theory. Yeah. And what it is, and how it's applicable in research. So I'm going to hand this over to our resident expert, London Donson, who's doing his research on critical race theory, and you can take it away.
Hello, everybody. thank you for calling me an expert. I appreciate that. Feels very good. So for those of you who don't know, or if you can't tell from my accent, I come from the United States, born and raised in California, lived a little bit in Missouri and Montana as well. And my research right now is definitely rooted in critical race theory. And I know we were talking about this before the show started, and I wanted to give you the way I think about critical race theory, the way I define critical race theory, is critical race theory is an in-depth analysis of how race functions and shapes society, particularly laws and policy, and then an extension of that, culture. And so a good example of this, which is a little in depth, but follow me here. In 2012, February 2012, Trayvon Martin, 17-year-old unarmed African-American teen, was shot and killed by a 28-year-old man named George Zimmerman.
Yeah.
George Zimmerman was the neighborhood watch, and he saw Trayvon just walking down the street, and based on nothing else, based on no information other than what he looked like, the fact that he was wearing a hoodie, the fact that he was African-American, he deemed that he was suspicious and dangerous, and then decided to follow him against the advice of the police who he had already called. This led to an interaction, and at the end of this interaction, Trayvon Martin was killed. So we can look at this and say, okay, this is a flashpoint in time, a racially charged moment in history, right? Okay, so taking a critical race theory perspective on this, how does this apply to everything else? So we can go back to not the beginning, but almost the beginning. We'll look back at post-Civil War, post-slavery in the United States, and what did that look like?
So is that the antebellum?
Period. Antebellum, the right. Reconstruction, yes, right. Exactly.
Okay.
And it's particularly within the South. So you have a lot of these slaves who have now been freed. A lot of them don't know what to do. They don't know where to go. Mm-hmm. They have the culture that they've built since they've been here and since their ancestors have been here. But beyond that, they don't have any wealth or mobility access, right?
Yeah.
And so because a lot of the wealthy whites had lost their labor for the large part, right?
Yeah.
What the governments did in individual states and individual counties was they created vagrancy laws.
Mm. Right.
Mm. And vagrancy laws essentially stated that it was illegal for any man, any freedman, to not have a work contract or essentially to be loitering in public. And a lot of the laws weren't written specifically, you know, saying, oh, like specifically targeting necessarily freedmen or targeting, you know, blacks. But in most cases, in an overwhelming majority of those cases, they were targeted at former slaves.
Mm.
And in order to get a job, someone has to want to pay you, right?
Yeah.
But why would I pay you if you were a former slave? I can hire, if I'm going to pay someone, I'm going to pay this poor white guy who also wants the job, mm-hmm. right? So I have to want to give you the job. So a lot of these former slaves, they're really out. And no one wants to pay them because they didn't used to get paid. And the way that slavery has been baked into the culture for the past 300 years, 200 mm-hmm. years, no, you know, like the custom and the mindset is not to pay them.
Yeah.
Right? So they're out.
Yeah.
And so now they don't have work contracts. They don't know what they're doing. And so now they're getting arrested. And when they get arrested, they get fined.
Right.
They don't have any money.
Right. Yeah.
When they don't have the money to pay the fine, they get put into prison work, which is essentially a substitute for slavery.
Yeah.
Working in fields, working on chain gangs and things like that.
Right.
Right. And so you look at how vagrancy law, which existed for, I mean, you could, I mean, 60, 70 years in the United States in one way or another.
What years were these between?
This would have been like 1865 to like the 30s.
So is that,
and maybe even as late as the 50s in some places.
So that period of time is called the Reconstruction?
No, no. The Reconstruction would be like 65 to like 75, 80, eight of 18.
Okay.
So 1865 to about. The Reconstruction ended, I think, in 1882. There was an agreement between the Northern Democrats and the, or I should say, the Northern politicians and the Southern politicians to give the North the presidency, but end the Reconstruction in the South.
All right.
But the vagrancy laws started in the United States during the Reconstruction. And so this translates to Trayvon Martin very well, because it's the mindset that all you have to do is be black to be a criminal.
Right.
Right? To be, you're dangerous for no other reason other than that.
Yeah.
And so now we look at the Trayvon Martin situation. We say, okay, well, now there's this guy who's very white, passing Hispanic, who sees a kid walking home from 7-Eleven with Skittles and soda.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have this interaction, but it's the mindset that follows through.
Yeah.
And so critical race theory is this whole process that we just went through, is this idea of analyzing how is race functioning now?
Yeah.
How is it persisting through policy and history? And how is it affecting
into the culture.
And into the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, did you have a question?
Yeah, it's just about one thing. You really brought up a good point in regards to right after slavery, there's, you know, in the vagrancy law. So half of the people who say, I don't want to work, had to abide by the vagrancy laws. If you didn't want to abide by that, you became what we call a sharecropper.
Mm.
So sharecropping became this big thing where you didn't have nowhere to live, but as a used-to-be slave owner, I'll let you live on my land, and you mine the fields, and you can live there. And I'll pay you money now, and you become a sharecropper.
But because you're living on my land, you're renting from me. Yeah. Oh, you don't have the actual supplies, the equipment, so you're going to rent that from me too.
Right.
So even though you're working for me, you're never actually catching up monetarily because you're constantly paying the money back for the rent and for the equipment. And so it's just slavery by another name.
Can I ask a little bit about that vagrancy law?
Mm.
So that look, you could be, did people have to work around with permits where they could be and couldn't be? Or did you just have to be gathering in a place
or
and then
you having a work contract? Like you had to have a work contract.
You had to have a work contract.
Look, I'm working.
So like the Black Codes, so the vagrancy laws are part of a larger set of laws called the Black Codes, right? And the Black Codes came into being at the same time. And a part of that said, like, if you wanted to work, like, you had to have a work contract. It means that you had to get a work contract from like, a white business owner.
Right.
Said, so, like, you couldn't just go work anywhere without getting a work contract. And getting those work contracts was hard unless you probably had, like, a very particular skill. Like, unless you were, as a former slave, particularly skilled at something that most other people wouldn't be, even other like white people.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and really, really quickly in regards to the laws, it's not even like laws today. I mean, if you think about police brutality today, like imagine what police brutality was back then before it was really called that, right? So whether the law was there, either they were going to kill him or they were going to put him in jail. So the law was just a matter of a way of, what's the word? Justifying slavery. So
yeah.
It wasn't about, you know, it was all about killing them or putting them in jail.
And there's a big argument, I would say not an argument, but there's a big difference in terms of how African Americans were treated before slavery ended and after slavery ended. There's an argument to be made that they were treated better as slaves than after. And the reason is because when they were slaves, they were owned by someone. They were somebody's property. And if I'm as a slave owner, if I go out and I buy 5 slaves, I'm investing in these slaves to work.
Right.
Right? If slavery is ended and I don't own them anymore, I have no investment, but I also don't care about them at all.
You still don't see them as human.
You still don't see them as human. Exactly. Mm. And so the brutality that is now occurring against them is worse because there's no one looking out for them at all. Right. Because like if your slave runs away, you want him back in most cases because you want him to work for you.
Yeah.
If you are on the chain gang and you run away, you're just you don't belong to anybody.
Yeah.
And then tie that in with the fact that there's resentment about the fact that slavery has ended, all the things that come along with that. So there's an argument to say that African Americans were treated possibly even harsher during the time after slavery than they were during slavery for that reason.
Could I add possibly that it's that slaves or slave people were more disposable for after slavery had been removed, that because now they don't care about them and there's no reason to like chase after them.
That's exactly it.
You're less than a property, I would say.
That's exactly it. Yeah. You're less than property. So if I invest in property, I bought that property for a reason. I bought you so that you can work my land. And if you run away, I can cut off a finger. I can whip you. I can punish you. But you're still going to come back and you're still going to work this land.
Yeah.
If you run away and I don't own you and you're just a criminal and we don't like you because you're black.
And you're not a commodity.
You're not a commodity anymore. You're disposable.
So you could basically say that after there was kind of like lesser rights to say people. Okay, that's a reach to say rights. But like there was lesser value a black person.
Less value. Less
value. I would just say that was no need to have restraint. So normally the value was the same. Mm. But if I need to use you, then why kill you? But if I can't use you as a slave and I don't see you as an equal, then I don't have any restraint to get rid of you.
And think about it like this too.
I mean,
it's not only what value you as a slave or a former slave have or no longer have. It's the fact that you as a slave, if I'm on the slave patrol and I'm chasing you, right? I'm not chasing you just to catch you. I'm chasing you because you belong to somebody and someone is expecting you back.
And would there be rewards to catch them?
Yeah. A lot of the slave patrols, which modern day policing is very much modeled after.
A lot of the slave patrols were
like just citizens who lived in the town.
Yeah.
Right? And they got rewards from plantation owners for bringing their property back.
It's amazing when you're telling this story, and I'm thinking about the stories that I learned when I was in Australia from Indigenous people about the history of policing in Australia as well. It's exactly the same. But it came a little bit later, I think. I'm not sure. But they had the Act, and that was 1869. That was the Act was the Aboriginal Control Act. Mm. So they just called it the Act. And a lot of these were all controls on Aboriginal people and how they moved around in and around you know, cities, towns, whatever.
Yeah.
So it was like a permit. You had to have a permit and all this sort of stuff. So that's why I was asking about the permit.
With vagrancy laws, you had to have a contract to work. You could travel, right? But like if you travel to a different town and you're walking through town,
right,
you don't have a contract.
Yeah.
And so what this is really doing is it's limiting mobility and limiting political and economic power and growth that someone could gain.
It almost sounds like a passport.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's exactly what it sounds like, actually.
I want to ask a question in terms of that, too. Like, I mean, I guess the way I'm interpreting this and when I'm listening is that, you know, slaves have lost their economic value to the slave owner now, right? Because they're now free your economic value is now gone because I can't own you anymore.
Mm.
And the way I'm understanding it is that those laws that were made, the regulatory laws, were motivated by anti-black racism, right? They were motivated to make sure that a black man or black person doesn't gain economic wealth, mm-hmm. doesn't gain any sense of a means to gain economic wealth. Like, I guess coming back to CRT, I'm thinking that these laws are motivated by anti-blackness.
Mm-hmm.
They're motivated by viewing and understanding an African-American person as, to their essence, mm-hmm. a slave or a non-human.
Exactly.
That's just how I'm interpreting what you're saying.
And this really gets into my research. So I'm glad I think this is a good segue. So me growing up as a kid, I grew up around a lot of different people. Like, obviously, my family's black. They're African-American. But I went to school with a lot of, like, you know, European kids, Asian kids, Hispanic kids, Latin kids, very, very diverse. And so I spent a lot of times, whether in my neighborhood, at my school, at daycare, and, like, lots of different mixed spaces. Mm-hmm. And so in the United States, you have Black History Month, and you hear about Martin Luther King. Which is, I mean, these two things happen within like a month and a half of each other. And they teach you about slavery. But it's more like they tell you what happened. Mm. They tell you about the civil rights movement. They tell you what happened. There's not an in-depth analysis of what's happening here. Growing up, you know, people say, oh, you know, racism is bad. You shouldn't do these things. And for me, it was very confusing because I would go home, I'd go out into the world, and I would see these things happening. Like, okay, well, if we've all agreed that this is bad,
then why are they doing it?
Then why are we doing it?
Yeah.
And so from even that young age, I was very interested, almost obsessed to, like, what's going on here?
Mm.
And so I've grown up, and I've had these conversations in the shower, in the car, just laying in bed at night. What I want to know is, like, how can we end these things? How can we end racism? And I think growing up in, like, the 90s and, like, the early 2000s, there was a lot of questions of, like, especially in the United States, of is racism still a problem? You know,
post-racialism.
Is this still a thing? Mm.
Because you just had Obama, right? When did Obama come in?
This is before Obama.
Oh, before.
This is before
okay.
Obama. So I'm thinking about, like, when I'm, like, around, like, 9 to, like, 15 years old.
Mm.
Like, we're asking these questions, right? And then you get Obama.
Yeah.
And then you get a lot of racial backlash. And then you get Trump.
Trump.
And you have a lot of these and then you have the onset of the internet. And so you really start seeing these things on television.
Yeah.
People are recording things on their phone. And it starts to look just as bad as it's ever been, but it's really in your face,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I start asking myself, okay, well, how can we make sure that our children, like my children, how can I make sure that my children don't go through what my grandmother went through?
Mm.
And
but for young children that actually have to. Wouldn't they actually have to learn how racism isn't just interpersonal, it's embedded in systems, and this is where CRT comes in?
And this is where we're going.
Right,
this is exactly
okay,
where we're going.
Okay, now I'm with you, yeah.
And so the more I think about it, and Larry, you were talking about this, I think before we were on the air, about isms, mm-hmm. how isms, they dictate beliefs, right?
Yeah.
And so at some point I got to a point where I was like, okay, if you have racism and you think racism is bad, how do you get rid of racism? Mm,
you have to analyze the ism.
Mm, you have to analyze the ism.
Yeah.
But, like, I'll give you another example. If you had idolism and you think that idolism is bad, how do you get rid of idolism? You get rid.
Yeah, I was about to say.
You get rid of the idols,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so my analysis is that you get rid of race, right? And now follow me here.
Okay.
The way that I would define this in the United States, there are two races.
Right.
There's black and there's white. We can make an argument that Native American is its own thing, but that's also its own topic in and of its, in and of itself. There's black and there's white.
Right.
Everything else is in between, right? Everything else is like some kind of Asian, some kind of Hispanic. If you want to get into like European places, like there's like an actual ethnicity or culture that can be defined by what you're calling it. Black and white are the races, right?
Yeah.
The terms black and white as racial terms were created at the beginning of U.S. slavery.
I was just going to ask a question just in terms of like, so you're defining race in that context then by a structural, economic, political, social mm-hmm. power as mm-hmm. well. Is that kind of what you're doing? Like black in that context means very little to no social, economic power, et cetera, and then white means, and that, is that what you kind of mean in terms of like you're saying there everything else kind of fits in this weird little kind of
Can I try to paraphrase?
Yeah.
Because I understood. Because initially it caught me off guard, but then I caught on to what he was saying.
So
basically what he's saying is I've heard a comedian say that basically you either got white people or black people.
Mm.
So you could be European, you could be Mexican, you can be Russian, you can be South African, white, and you're all Thank white. You. But if you black, if you Maori, if you African, if you... some people, Mexican, Puerto Rican, Dominican, then you black. So what he's saying is that's the spectrum.
Yeah, like
so,
it has a social meaning.
I mean, kind of in a paraphrase.
I mean, what I'm really saying is you have people who are from Africa who have been brought to the United States as slaves.
Yeah.
And when this happens, you have English people, and England always gets off scot-free on this, the English people bringing the Africans over to the United States, and they have to justify this, right? They have to justify this to the people in England who, like, where the slave trade is also happening.
Yeah.
What they're telling people is that these Africans are not people. They're black. And the deeper meaning of that is that blackness as a concept, not as a person,
right.
means bad. It means ugly. It means right. evil.
Yeah.
Right. These people, these Africans are black.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. This works very well because of the phenotype.
Right. Like essentializing what that means.
Exactly. Right. Like, and
to,
so
like, to the essence, they're bad.
Exactly. Right. And so we're going to sell these people as an economic commodity to help our colonial efforts in the States.
Yeah.
Or what will become the States, I should say, because it's not the States yet.
Mm, yeah.
To gain economic power
right.
and to gain space, right? In doing that, and by labeling Africans black, they created white in and of themselves.
Yeah, because they had to be the opposite.
And the opposite of black is white, which is pure, good, beneficent.
Yeah.
Right? These things.
We just need to clarify one thing, though. So I agree with the thing, but the one thing, so initially... It was just Africans and slaves, and it was just the Americans who became Americans or people who were English, right?
Mm.
And then these were Africans. And then they became, when they created America, they got the Constitution, and then they said, hey, only white people are considered citizens, so you're American. And then after that, you were just whatever. It wasn't until after they abolished slavery when they started allowing black people to be citizens that you didn't have it to define what a black or a white race was.
Right.
So it wasn't initially just at slavery time. It wasn't until they abolished slavery. So once they start allowing black people to become citizens or Africans to become citizens, then they became Negroes. Negroes,
yeah.
Which is black, right?
Yeah, because so, I grew up in that era where that term was used as like, They went through, they had black, Negro, colored.
You had a whole lot of things
before you got to African American.
Yeah. So it was Negro. First it was Negroid.
Right.
Then it was Negro.
And that's a phenotype.
Oh, yeah. Then it was, and then it was from Negro, then it became, what was that? What did we get after that?
Colored.
Colored, yep. So colored for a long time. And then they realized, well, nah, y'all probably turns more colors than we do. So then they turned it to, we came back to, that's when we kind of were African Americans and
black.
What's interesting about that is that kind of still lives in Africa, as in most Africans that you talk to who travel abroad or who go abroad for like in the later years of their lives, or even as kids, we don't recognize that we're black until we go to the Western world. And like you arrive in the UK or the US, or when I went to Canada, that's when I was like, oh, I'm black. I didn't know that. That's not a thing in Africa to date.
Exactly. You're right. Because you're right. It only became a thing in America when they had to define the difference of American. Because before, Americans was just white and they had all the privileges. But then when they had to define a race, well, what are you? You're not just an American. Then you had to become of a race. But then you had this whole race wars. And that's why, you know. And
the deeper.
And we've got to also remember that throughout the West where colonization was happening, those strategies for colonizing people were being shared. Right, they're being shared from one country to another country to another country. So this is why, as you're talking, I'm actually, my brain is just lighting up all over because I'm seeing similarities and dissimilarities and things that are kind of similar and things that, you know, obviously have come from the same kind of thinking about the world, yeah, and about people in the world, yeah.
Yeah, so we have this at the beginning of slavery. You have this distinction between what people are, who people are, right? Black and white. And we can move on through time. But this gets built and baked into policy and the way that laws are shaped, right? This definition of who we are, right?
Byron mentioned a good one before you move from that, because you mentioned that. So go back to the law you mentioned around
the vagrancy laws.
The vagrancy laws. Right. But then you got to think about all the other things around the law. So laws aren't just about... also about negative black, but it's about giving other people privileges. So they're saying, hey, you can't apply for this job because you don't have a house, or you can't apply for this job because you don't have an education. Where only people who were getting education were the white people. So when those laws are written in a way to where it might not say, oh, if you're black, you can't get it. It'll just say that, but, hey, if you don't have a college degree.
But for a portion in time, that's were written
exactly,
like that.
Exactly.
Right.
In order to get benefits, you had to be labeled as black or you had to be labeled as white. Mm-hmm. And the people who decided who was who was the government.
So now I know, I do know about the paper bag test.
That's just more of,
but that's more recent, isn't it?
So technically that was from a sorority. Some people say that from a sorority in different ways from around the blackness.
Yeah. So like, because there would be people that would be black, but they could pass for white, right? Mm-hmm. So like, how did that work in that environment?
I mean, and that's kind of the whole thing, right? So let's take a step back. So when I was talking about you have these laws, you know, if you're black, if you're labeled as black by the government, you get less benefits. If you're labeled as white, you get more benefits. Eventually, you start having people come and immigrate to the United States, right? The American dream.
Right.
These people come from all over the world. They come from Asia. They come from Latin America. They come from Europe, East Europe, right? And they come here because they want the benefits, right? And they come like, oh, what they realize is that, okay, the people who are labeled as black, these people over here, they're getting it the worst. I don't want to be like them.
Right.
I don't want to associate with them. And so I'm not going to. Mm. Right. And so you start getting this colorism factor.
Yep.
And so when you have people who are white passing, right, it's seen as a benefit. Right.
Yeah.
I know a couple who lives in Montana. African-American male, the husband and his wife is European, and he's on the podcast. Actually, he's one of the episodes
on
the podcast.
Yep.
And he talks about on the podcast about how he has conflicted feelings about how he's happy that his son that they had is of a lighter skin tone.
Right.
Because his son won't have to deal with some of the things that even he had to do. And he's lighter than everyone else in this room. The father.
Yeah.
But the son is, I mean, you would never know.
And the podcast that London mentioned is Between Race and Reason. I've been listening to it on Spotify. I'm up to about episode 4.
Okay.
Yeah. Really enjoying it. And really recommend people go and have a listen to that.
Yeah.
So carry on about, the whole situation.
So really what this all boils down to is we have a narrative in our head of what it means to be black or white.
Yeah.
If I told you, Byron, that a white guy walked in the door right now, you didn't turn around, you couldn't look at him at all. He's walked in the room right now. All you know is that he's white.
Mm.
What else can you tell me about him?
What else can I tell you about?
Yeah.
Or are you asking what I'm thinking as soon as that person?
This is the thought experiment.
I mean, you know what I'm thinking of straight away?
Yeah.
John Key. You know who John Key is?
Yeah.
Like former Prime Minister John Key.
Mm.
That's all I think of. I just think of a middle class white man.
Mm.
As soon as you say white person, white person, that's what I'm thinking.
Mm.
Yeah. Which again comes with its own, as you were trying to say, its own set of understandings and
beliefs.
Yeah. About what it is to be white.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What it means to be white. Right. What it means to
yeah.
be more likely to be middle class, what it means to be middle class, et cetera, et cetera, that kind of thing.
Mm.
And so the point that I'm getting at is that if we think about ourselves as black and white, we're thinking about ourselves as people who live in race, people who are of a race.
Right.
Right? And therefore, we're not detaching ourselves from the narrative that is race.
Okay.
And therefore, could we ever expect to get away from racism?
Right.
In the world. So
is this then what critical race theory is saying? Or is this how you're using
critical race? This is how I'm using critical race theory.
Right, for your research.
For my research.
Right.
Because he said earlier that your idea is that we get away from thinking about race.
Yeah.
We get away from identifying ourselves as
according
races.
To race.
So then using critical race theory to think more critically about our understanding and positioning within race.
It's really interesting that you said that, because that's exactly what policy did here.
Mm.
It moved away from race except for one group.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And then the rest, everybody else disappeared.
Mm.
Right? So because we're talking about ethnicity, it's mm-hmm. taken years and years and years mm-hmm. for Pacifica people to be recognized, because we had Māori and you had New Zealand European. But in my mind, New Zealand European, what is that?
Well, I guess someone what you're from, saying, right, is that
that's still,
that has meaning.
To
that
me,
has meaning.
That has meaning because if you're new, I mean, look, if you're European, New Zealand European, however you want to say it, you're claiming the fact, you're owning the fact that you are from Europe.
Mm.
And that has meaning. So
yeah.
if I'm in the States and I say you're European American, if you're not white, you're European, that has meaning.
Mm.
Right? I'm acknowledging that one, you're not American.
Right.
You're not just American, you're European American. You came here. Rhetorically, subconsciously, it's acknowledging the fact that your people, your ancestors, did not originate here. They colonized.
Right.
And I don't need to say all of that out loud when I'm calling you European American, because you know.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think some of the backlash that I've gotten about this idea was like, well, you can't get rid of race because that's like colorblindness. I'm like, to me, the color's never going to go away. I had this woman in my class, she tried to tell me that if we got rid of the terms black and white, if she couldn't call herself white anymore, then people of color wouldn't look at her and think that she was white.
Yeah, but you're not talking about the color of her skin, right? You're talking about the social meaning behind white in terms of a racial concept.
Exactly.
Because
I think that's what she's kind of missing.
It flips a lot, I think, doesn't it? Like, I'm feeling like it's flipping a lot from, okay, you've got white as a social construct, and you've got European as you're supposed to, with meaning, and you're from Europe.
Mm.
But at the same time, the word European is used to mean white people wherever you're from. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have to be from Europe.
Yeah, because it's kind of
so it's almost like...
But that's getting back into the fact that if you're European, that your ancestors got here how?
Mm.
And I think that... And that's kind of the point of, like, we can talk about, like, a white person walking into the door, What do I know about that person if I don't know anything else? The only narrative in my head, if I don't know what language he speaks, if I don't know what country he's from, if I don't know what food he eats, if I don't know what clothes he wears, I know nothing about his culture. The narrative in my head is going to be a racial narrative that is relating that person to the opposite, which is black.
So that's the thing about what racism is. Racism ain't about what somebody color is. It's about what you, the negative thought that you have about that.
Or just the thought.
The negative thought. It's not, so if you look at somebody, be like, oh, I love that Mexican woman. I love that African woman. I love that European woman. It's not racism, is it?
Well, it could be.
Why?
I think that when, you know, fetishism.
Yeah.
Fetishism is a form of appreciating other cultures, but it's not really.
No, no, but what I'm saying is we're changing it. That's the thing.
Yeah.
It's but not I mean, racism, like I'm saying. Racism.
But she's giving you an example.
I'm giving you an example of how racist thinking can appear positive, even when it's not. Right. Like for me growing up, when I had dreadlocks and stuff, I'd have people come and touch my hair. They'd be like, and they just felt like they had the right to do that. And really in their brains, they're being trying to be positive for me.
You. Oh, appreciating. You know, like, so nice. You got nice hair.
Exactly. Yeah. Or when my son was a baby and he was just gorgeous and everybody who came up to him used to try and grab his cheeks. And he got very scared of, you know, especially, and it was, it always used to be Pākehā woman. They come up and they go, oh, he's so cute, and they grab him and stuff. And he just started screaming all the time when he saw them because he'd gotten traumatized by being grabbed. Even though they were being nice, they felt that they could go further and actually touch the child without even talking to the mother or, you know, just reach in, right? So I'm not saying that. What I'm observing from what
London
has said, sorry London, is that critical race theory is looking at how we process our thoughts about race or how we process our thoughts in general and how race factors in, even if it's subliminally. Would that make sense? I'm not sure.
No. That is the research that I am doing.
Oh, okay.
Right? Critical race theory is just the analysis of how race itself applies itself to society in an in-depth fashion. So my in-depth analysis of race is that race operates as a binary that was created at the beginning of U.S. slavery.
Right, okay.
And that in order to get away from race, or at least to begin a meaningful long-term process of getting away from racism, we should stop using the racial terms black and white to identify each other, to identify ourselves. This goes for both white and black people.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for people who are of African descent, the other side of that means doing the work to figure out what you want to be called. It's because it needs to be self-deterministic, right? Because I can't go and be like, okay, well, we're all going to be called African American because that's what I decided.
Mm.
No, the deeper factor here is that for a lot of African Americans whose ancestors were slaves, they don't know where they came from, other than the fact that they know that they came from Africa,
right?
And so a lot of times in the United States, you have sort of this like big identity crisis of who the African-American black population is because of that. And that factors out in like different ways that we could talk about. And that's, I mean, that could be like a whole another conversation, right?
Yeah.
But for what I'm saying is to get away from racism, we need to do the work ourselves to self-determine who we are beyond being black. Someone that was not us decided to call us black.
Right.
And then they defined everything about us by that title.
Yep.
And so to me, to continue using that title, that definition, is just to call us by our oppression.
Okay, I'm with you. Yep.
And so in order to get away from it, we need to have the agency within ourselves. Let me take a step back here, right? Because Larry was right. We went from, you know, being slaves to being Negroes to being colored, and then we went to being black. We've been called black by the structures of the United States forever, since the beginning of slavery, right?
Right.
People of African descent in the United States didn't start calling themselves black until the Black Power Movement at the end of the 40s and the 1950s.
Right.
It was a reclaiming of the term because of the oppression that they were going through,
yeah,
to put power back into it. My question is, are we at a point now where we can do this work to redefine who we are ourselves, to give ourselves more agency, and then to begin a process that is more meaningful and long term?
Yeah.
And that's what my research is.
Okay, Larry.
Yeah, I mean, I go for that, like, because he, you know, he makes good points around, like, what we're called, like, and I'm in the mind fact, like, I don't care what you call me, like, long as you don't call me out my name, and, like, as long as in the right way, but you call me black, Negro, like, you call me a nigger, like, you better be black, but outside of that, I don't really care what you call me, to be honest. What I really care about is, really don't even care how you treat me in per se, because I'm going to demand that, but what I care about is the system. Right, I want to know that the laws that are there, because until they fix the systems, they need to fix the institutions, that, hey, the kids that can go to these schools, that the kids that can do these type of things, and into the jobs that everybody can get, into the, that's what I want to fix. I don't care what they call me. Mm-hmm. So they can call me, like, I don't care. Like, I don't care.
Do you think that's a generational thing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
I kind of
feel the same way like you about those sorts of things too. I'm more interested in the systems. I'm not too fussed about name calling, because I always think if somebody calls me a name, I can call them a name right back. We're on the same level here. But if that thinking is preventing me getting housing or preventing me getting access or preventing me getting anything, or getting access or having access to resources or something like that, because they have a particular way of thinking about me.
London said it already. Yeah. We've been called 5 different things over the years, right? But what hasn't changed in all that? The government system ain't changed. The school system ain't changed. So you can change the name to 6 or 7, 8 more times, but if you ain't changing the system.
Well, I feel like one question that has also been on my mind through all of this is that even if you take away those terms, black and white, how do you still acknowledge and also sort of start to decolonialize a country that is built on colonialism? So how do you still acknowledge what has happened? How do you acknowledge a government that is foundationally rooted in the oppression of African people and shift away from other terms?
There's a lot of work to do. And my argument doesn't suggest that changing these terms, getting away from these terms, solves all of the problems, first and foremost. To me, it's a beginning, and it's a starting place. And so I think it's exactly that. It's the starting place. And I think that a lot of it has to do with power and the power that we're able to take and give ourselves. I think there's a very big difference in self-determining who you are and letting someone else call you what they think you are. And if we're all growing up in the system, we all know what black and white are.
Yeah.
Right? And if black and white are acceptable terms, that means that every white person, every Hispanic person, every Mexican person, every Asian person, they are also seeing these terms, which means that they are also seeing and living in this narrative internally of like who we are in relation to who they are.
So what do you call that? You call that it's the culturalization or something of a particular way of thinking.
It's the internalization of racism within a culture.
But again, that's about belief systems. So you put those belief systems in narratives and movies and the news and whatever narrative you want.
Yeah. And so I'll say one more thing.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think I said it before, it's about power and how can we take that power?
Yeah.
Right? And so it's not about us saying, okay, hey, government, stop calling us this. We don't want to be called this anymore. You know, no, it's just saying, oh no, this is what I'm called. This is who I am. And this is what you're going to call me because this is what I decided.
Yeah.
Right. If you look at what the LGBTQ community is doing right now in terms of like pronouns, right? They didn't ask for permission to do that.
No.
Right? But really they're changing the entire perspective of who they are or the power that they have.
There's a very interesting conversation we can have on another day about that. Because, in regards to New Zealand. I want to bring you in now because you're doing your whole thesis on racism and housing. So we got about 5 minutes, 6 minutes left.
Right.
So I really want to get you in here and you talking about how it's applicable in your research.
Well, I mean, there's kind of two things I want to say. So like, firstly, I've used critical race theory very briefly in my research, but it's been more in terms of like an approach to my methodology. And that's mostly so like, it's quite academic in that sense. It's so in academia, you oftentimes have, especially with research on ethnic groups or whatever, it's oftentimes a powerful group talking about a different group, you know, like a white American, some are black Americans, et cetera. And what critical race theory tries to do is says, hey, look, actually we need to have a section in which people are telling their own stories and their own narratives. So there's this thing called counter storytelling, which is basically just allowing people who have had their stories omitted from kind of mainstream outlets, whether that be academia, whether it be media, et cetera, have an opportunity to tell their own stories. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do with this research, is that I'm interviewing people so that they can tell their own stories. And I try to, and then critical race theory then informs the kind of questions that I have, which allows people to tell their own stories without just going, without filling out a survey, you know what I mean? Like, I could, if I wanted people to answer specific questions, I could just give them a survey and go fill that out. Whereas I want to start off with like, hey, tell me about yourself. What's going on? Like, what's your journey? Kind of how I've done interviews before. I say, hey, what's your journey to where you are now? Let's find out about you.
Yes, so I sent poor I sent poor Byron home traumatized after telling him my story. So
but I think
I only give it to him in small doses.
Yeah, the interview was like 2 hours. I'm going to transcribe that. But I mean, like, I think that's quite an important part of using CRT is that it's like, hey, for a long time, the cultural narratives around race and racism and ethnicity have often been told by what's the actual proverb, you know, like if all the stories are told by the hunter, you know, like as that idea, it's like, well, we need to change that narrative and go, hey, actually, there's something else that's going on here. Let's hear.
Because even the values that academia, if academia is mainly Pākehā run, right, even the values in that research will overwhelmingly be Pākehā values.
Yeah, well, because
right? So how you collect the stories.
Yeah,
you know,
everyone comes from a like you've got two things that happens in academia. You've got the kind of long established way that academia does things, especially sociology and anthropology are very problematic. But then you've also got that, you know, we've tried to move away from that objective observer, is that we come to the research with something specific. And by coming as a person who's experienced racism and as an African in New Zealand, I've got a certain perspective in which I will honour those stories more so than, hopefully, than a Pākehā
like
person would.
I think it's that what's that, you can't be unbiased.
Yeah,
you always
unbiased,
have a bias, whoever you are.
As simple as that, you come from a certain perspective.
And even if they try to say they're unbiased, they actually are.
Yeah, and it informs the way they interpret and understand what they're receiving from the participant. But secondly, the other aspect that I also want to talk about here was kind of jumping off from what some of what London said, is that these ideas of black and African have informed the way that participants have had landlords interact with them. You know, they've missed out on housing because they're black and they're African. People have asked, hey, is this person trustworthy or not? Like all these ideas of what it means to be African, what it means black in New Zealand, in the New Zealand context is that itself shapes and informs the way that people interact with them. And that then shapes outcomes, you know, like people might have more than enough money to rent this place, but because they're black, I don't want to rent to you. So they'll find every excuse to either kick you out the house or to avoid renting to you. So like, you know.
And Buddy does want to have that conversation with you too. Munya.
Oh, right. Cool.
Munya.
Cool. So these, you know, coming back from that idea of like, how do we talk about race? You know, as much as name calling is one thing, I do think those conversations are quite structural too. You know, like, where do you get information from? How do you understand Africa? Media.
Yeah.
The common narratives they get that's put into education, that kind of stuff. So like, these ideas of what we're understood to be as Africans informs and shapes people's ability to get housing. Mm-hmm. In my specific context, it probably shapes many other aspects of people's lives.
And to be clear, the goal is, by identifying ourselves, is that we are beginning to reshape these narratives. Yeah. It's the beginning of the reshaping of that narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've only got about 3 minutes left, I think. But I've got a question that I wanted to ask you, and this is like a real layman's question. I just thought it was a good one. I heard it on the Tim Wise show, and I thought, that's a really good question. How do we talk to people who don't want to do anything except state untrue rhetoric about what CRT actually is? How do we communicate with those people? Or do we just give up and throw them out? What do we do? throw them out with the garbage.
Any idea? I mean, I can talk about like personal approaches that I take to people kind of pushing back and things. I tend to just keep asking them questions to find out,
right,
what kind of clarity do you have about this? And do you realize you're being ridiculous yet? Cool, now I'm just going to give you... the way I always say is I give people pieces, bits and pieces, because the stuff that I come from, I've been doing this for years. I've been researching and reading this for years. People haven't. So I have my approach to most things is quite gentle anyway. So I tend to just kind of ask them questions like, why do you think that way? Da, da, da. Then I kind of go, well, when you said that... I'll give you one example. When I was talking to someone about police brutality in the States, he said to me, well, you know, don't you understand that sometimes cops go into these places, they get told that it's very dangerous, etc. They go in there quite, quite armed up and quite cautious. And I said, well, what you've done just now is you've explained to me that the situation is more complex than the media make it out to be. Don't you think then that on the other side, there's just as complex a story, which is misunderstood? And he stopped and said, oh, yeah, I do. I see what you mean. And that's often how I deal with people. They will say something. I kind of go, well, using your example, because you came up with the logic, let me flip that on its head and then now interact and think about that. That's how I've tended to deal with people who want to deliberately misinterpret stuff.
Yeah.
I do the same thing. I ask them to explain more.
Right.
You know,
because I'd like a takeaway for people. Like, you know, no doubt people are talking about anti-racism or experiencing racism. So like, they need tools. Like, that was the main thing for me growing up, that I didn't find any tools until I got to university. These were my tools until I got to university.
I think it's always good, if you're talking to someone who disagrees with you, to ask them more questions.
Yeah. Right.
Tell me more is a good place to start.
Yeah.
Tell me more about what you're talking about. Otherwise you're going to end up arguing with them.
Yeah.
By Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.